dead, a horrifying casualty in our long civil war. Who takes the reins of government now? On whose shoulders falls the daunting task of reuniting North and South, restoring the Union? This man, Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's vice president, a Democrat.
Well, that was dramatic, wasn't it? This is, in fact, your weekly constitutional, and I am, in fact, Stuart Harris, and we're going to talk about the Constitution today, and we're going to talk about what was just mentioned in that segment. That was actually part of the introduction to a film that is shown in Greenville, Tennessee, at the Visitor Center for the Andrew Johnson National Historic Site. Andrew Johnson, the often overlooked president who picked up the reins of power immediately after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Now, that's a tough act to follow. I mean, I feel kind of the same way about Andrew Johnson that I do about John Adams. I mean, he followed George Washington, or maybe more appropriately, Lyndon Johnson, who followed JFK. When you follow a great president, a popular president, and especially one who's been tragically assassinated, you tend to pale in comparison. You tend to have rough waters, and you tend not to be treated very well by the history books. But wow, certainly Andrew Johnson is a president who's worthy of a lot more attention than we normally give him, and not just because he was the first president in our history to be impeached, but because he faced such enormous challenges during the period we commonly call Reconstruction. So I went to the Andrew Johnson National Historic Site in Greenville, Tennessee, and I spent a day there with several park rangers from the historic site, and I certainly appreciate their time. And to put this in context for us and to talk about this very difficult period of time and perhaps the climax of it, which was the impeachment of Andrew Johnson, I have with me one of my students from the Appalachian School of Law. His name is Eric von Kleist, and he has just finished my course in constitutional law, so he's an expert. Hello, Eric.
Good afternoon, Professor Harris.
Thank you so much for coming here to Johnson City.
Thank you for the invitation. It's a beautiful town.
It is a beautiful town, and it's a beautiful radio station. And we're talking about a very interesting subject. Why don't you tell us what impeachment is?
Well, let's start with the word impeachment. It comes from the French, which where the French word empêcher, which means to hinder, and like most of our big words, that in turn comes from the Latin word, which in this case was impedicare, which means to fetter or to bind the feet of someone.
To bind someone, okay.
Impeachment is actually a proceeding against a public officer for some crime or misfeasance in office. It's an accusation, a charge against the public officer.
I see. And where does that appear in our Constitution?
Well, the impeachment, the ability to impeach or to bring charges against a public officer comes in Article 1 of the Constitution, and the House of Representatives is given the sole authority to raise an impeachment against an officer of the Constitution.
Okay, so the House simply impeaches the president and then he's out of office? Is that how it works?
Not quite. Impeachment, again, is just a charge against the person. The House brings the charges. At that point, the Senate gets involved, as does the Supreme Court. The Senate becomes the court that hears the charges, and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, in the case of the president, sits in judgment over the proceedings and conducts the proceedings as a court proceeding so that it doesn't become a political circus, essentially.
I see. Okay. And how many times have we witnessed such a spectacle in our history?
Well, I've only witnessed one,
uh-huh.
But there have been two occasions on which presidents have been impeached.
Okay.
Andrew Johnson was impeached in 1868, mm-hmm. and then William Jefferson Clinton was impeached within my lifetime.
I see. So many of us remember that because, of course, that was televised. Unfortunately, of course, television wasn't around back when Andrew Johnson was impeached. But tell us about that impeachment. What happened there?
Well, Andrew Johnson succeeded to the presidency upon the death of President Lincoln, the assassination of President Lincoln. He had several differences of opinion with the current Congress, which was called the Radical Republican Congress. The Radical Republican Congress wanted a very punitive reintegration of the South. They mm-hmm. wanted to draw it out. They wanted the former Confederacy to essentially prove its loyalty to the United States before allowing it to be readmitted. And Andrew Johnson was following President Lincoln's footsteps and wanted a very quick and very painless in a reintegration of the South. And that clash of ideas led to the impeachment, the circumstances that brought forth the impeachment.
Yeah, that was the real context here, is that there were at least two very different perspectives on Reconstruction, you know, bringing the South back into the Union. Because, of course, that was the reason that the North went to war. I mean, slavery was certainly a big issue and certainly a big cause of the Civil War, probably the biggest cause of the Civil War. But the North went to war to preserve the Union, at least initially, and slavery wasn't actually a war aim until after the Emancipation Proclamation. So if that's the reason the North went to war, how do you actually bring the South back into the Union? And that was the basic conflict, wasn't it, between Johnson and the Congress?
Correct. As we mentioned, the Congress was very punitive in nature in terms of the readmission of the Confederate States, and Johnson wanted more of a healing process and to forgive and forget, essentially.
Yeah, to let them up easy, I think he once said. And he was a Southerner himself. He was from Tennessee.
He was. He originally from North Carolina. Ended up in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. He was a man of a lot of contradictions. He was the closest a white person of the period could have become to being a slave at one point in his life.
He was
an indentured servant and an apprentice, and ran away from that, in fact. And the tailor to whom he was apprenticed sought to have him returned, but was unsuccessful.
Ah, so Johnson escaped, and that's when he got up to Tennessee then, and he escaped from that. But then Johnson himself later owned slaves.
He later owned slaves, which he later emancipated before the Emancipation Proclamation came into before the 15th Amendment came into effect.
Yeah, he's a man of remarkable contradictions. So he's a Southerner. He was pro-Union.
He was pro-Union, threatened to hang Southern senators who seceded.
Right, but he was a slave owner.
Was a slave owner, but had essentially been close to a slave himself.
And ultimately, when he is in a position to reintegrate the South, actually turned into a very
generous
president, or would-be generous president. Mm-hmm. So, wow, fascinating fellow, fascinating process. Was he actually removed from office?
He was not.
Uh-huh.
There was an impeachment trial. The House of Representatives brought 11 articles of impeachment against him, and there were two votes. They sort of consolidated some of the articles into one vote.
Right.
Each time he was acquitted by the Senate on a 35-19 vote, just one vote short of the two-thirds majority that it would have taken to convict him of the crimes that he was accused of.
So by one vote, he avoids being removed from office. Dramatic story. Thank you very much, Eric, for that very interesting context for Andrew Johnson and his impeachment. And now let's go and talk to Kendra Hinkle, a ranger at the National Park Service's Andrew Johnson National Historic Site.
Well, the Constitution was the guiding light in Andrew Johnson's political career. And one of my favorite political cartoons of Andrew Johnson is it has the body of a parrot, but the head of Andrew Johnson, and the text just says Constitution, Constitution, Constitution. So even people back then realized that that was what he repeated. That was his guiding factor for every political decision that he made. And when he died, he said that he wanted no better winding sheet than the flag, and he asked that his copy of the Constitution be buried with him as well.
That's remarkable. And so he's buried with the Constitution under his head.
Many sources say the Constitution under his head, but as I went through and transcribed the obituaries, firsthand accounts, nearly every document said the Constitution was under his hand.
Under his hand?
Yes.
Maybe that was just a misprint then.
Exactly. You know, under his head, under his hand. He did at once say he wanted no softer pillow than the Constitution, so I can see where the two might have gotten morphed.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, we have to look to the primary sources, so
right.
It's probably under his hand.
Mm-hmm.
And his body's actually wrapped in an American flag.
Right.
Now, before we get much further, I have to say, you know, that Andrew Johnson was from impoverished circumstances. He was apprenticed, correct me if I'm wrong, at the age of 9 to a tailor, and he ran away and came here to Greenville and worked as a tailor and was barely literate when he came here. Where did he pick up the Constitution? Where did he get familiar with it? When did he develop this devotion to the Constitution? Was that one of the things his wife read to him at the tailor shop, perhaps? Or
it's possible. And he paid people the rate of 50 cents to read to him. And a lot of what they read were not only books like The American Speaker, but speeches that were given, you know, in newspapers. And I'm sure that a lot of those just sort of piqued his interest as those elements came into play.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And maybe at some point some scholar will go back and figure out when the first time was that he started developing this interest. But even today, a lot of politicians, I sometimes wonder whether they've ever read the document. Most Americans probably have not read it all the way through. And that level of devotion, and quite honestly, the level of sophisticated reasoning that he used in his later battles is remarkable for anyone, but particularly for somebody who never had any formal education.
Right.
Okay. Well, with that as a starting point or a starting observation, could you start telling us about Johnson's political career and how the Constitution figured in it, please?
Well, Andrew Johnson started out as alderman of the town of Greenville, and he held nearly every political office that you can hold on the path to the presidency. He went to mayor, governor, Tennessee representative, Tennessee senator, U.S. senator, U.S. representative, vice president, president, and he even held the position of military governor in Tennessee during the Civil War. And the Constitution, as I said, was his guiding principle for every political decision that he made. And our film is entitled Defender of the Constitution.
Yeah, I just saw that over at the Visitor Center. It's a very good film, incidentally.
Right.
And Fred Thompson helped you with that, didn't he?
He did. He was the person who cast the first vote when we opened our new exhibits and we had the ballot box.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did the voice of Andrew Johnson on our film.
Now, you have to explain that for our listeners.
Okay.
So you actually have a ballot box so that visitors to the Visitor Center can vote on the impeachment.
Right.
As to whether they think he should have been impeached or not. And periodically you publish the results, right?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. We give each visitor a copy of the ticket used to get into Andrew Johnson's impeachment trial. They can keep the main part of the ticket as a souvenir, and the smaller part they tear off and use it to vote in the museum area. We have a ballot box that says guilty and not guilty, so they can make their decision. Every year on the anniversary of the Senate count, we tally up the votes and we publish the results both on our website and in the newspaper.
So how does old Andy do?
He has been acquitted by more than one vote by the public, so we're happy.
Every time,
that.
He's always
acquitted.
Yes. He's
usually,
never been convicted.
Never. It's usually a majority of several thousand to a few hundred. So.
I see.
Yes.
I see. Well, I'm glad to see he's being vindicated on a daily basis here. Okay, so he was actually, if we could start before the Civil War, maybe when he was a congressman or a senator, he was very much an advocate of states' rights.
Yes.
But on the other hand, and he owned slaves.
Right.
So in that sense, at least, he was pro-slavery. But he felt that secession was not only a bad policy, he thought it was unconstitutional.
Right.
So that put him in a very small group of people, which were pro-Union Southerners, and an even smaller group who actually had considered the constitutionality of secession. He just didn't think it was something states could do, did he?
Right. And he used the word restoration in lieu of the term reconstruction because it was his philosophy that states could not commit treason. It was the people within the states who could commit the treason. And he was carrying out Lincoln's more lenient plan of restoration or reconstruction by saying that as soon as a certain percentage of the population of the states took the oath of allegiance, they could start holding elections and sending representatives back to Congress.
That's very interesting. So his theory was that though an individual, you know, Robert E. Lee, for example, by actually bearing arms against the United States, would technically come under that definition of treason that's set out in Article 3 of the Constitution, but whether Robert E. Lee or Jefferson Davis or any other Confederate committed treason was an individual matter. The state itself never actually left the Union. And so all that was necessary after the war was to reconstitute the state governments mm-hmm. and then let them start to function again.
Right.
But they never had actually left the Union.
Right.
That's a very interesting theory.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as we get to that point, it'll tell us a great deal about why Johnson took his perspective as opposed to that of the radical Republicans and others in Congress. But at any rate, that was even before the war. So before the war, he's a senator from Tennessee, a slaveholding state. He speaks against secession several times, didn't he?
Right.
And how did his fellow Tennesseans react to that?
East Tennessee was predominantly Union.
So that was okay with them?
It was. a little bit harsher view in Middle and West Tennessee. East Tennessee tried to break away from the rest of Tennessee when the state seceded, kind of
like West Virginia.
In the same vein as West Virginia, exactly. And, you know, Johnson's speeches probably had, you know, some rallying factor as far as that is concerned, but ultimately the attempt failed. And
right, because he was senator of the whole state.
Right.
And in fact, hadn't he been governor by that time as well?
Yes.
So he had had statewide offices,
right.
more than one of them, and so he was relatively well received here in the East, mm-hmm. but less so elsewhere. And of course, talking generally about why Northeast Tennessee or East Tennessee was more pro-Union, it probably had something to do with topography.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, could you talk about that? There just weren't as many slaves here, were there?
East Tennessee was smaller farms, more mountainous. You didn't have the broad plains and the large plantation-style farming. So there really wasn't the need for great slave populations like there were in Middle and West Tennessee as well.
Right, especially, I guess, over in West Tennessee. I mean, you're really sort of Mississippi
Delta
area there, and that would be more of the big plantations and more slaves.
Right.
So, in fact, this entire central Appalachian region, even southwest Virginia, where the Appalachian School of Law is situated, was, generally speaking, pro-Union.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that gets obscured now in 2011 when we're recording this interview, is that you see somebody flying a Confederate
right.
flag today, and you'll think, probably not too much
reversed.
Confederate. Yeah, not in this region, you know,
exactly.
over in Middle or West Tennessee, maybe. Okay, so Johnson is he's pro-Union, mm-hmm. even as secession occurs. And so when Tennessee actually secedes, he stays in the Senate, doesn't he?
Yes, he's the only United States senator who kept a seat when their state left the Union.
That must have been very lonely.
Must have been.
Wow, talk
Andrew
about...
Johnson was one known to hold for his principles.
It reminds one of that old story, the man without a country.
Mm-hmm.
He was a senator without a state,
mm-hmm.
at least for a while.
Right.
And what did he do after that point? I mean, what do you do when your state has tried, at least, to leave the Union and you're sitting in Washington, D.C.?
He served on several committees. He helped Abraham Lincoln decide on appointments for people.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1862, when Middle and West Tennessee came back under Union control, he was appointed military governor of the state. So straight from Senate back into reconstituting the state government in Tennessee.
Very interesting. And Tennessee was among the first parts of the rebel-held territory that was brought back into the
right.
Union through military action.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so now he's the military governor. Does he then move back to Tennessee to take that job?
He does. Absolutely.
Was he in Knoxville or where?
He lived in Nashville.
Nashville, okay. Mm-hmm. Makes sense. State capital.
And his family was still living here in Greenville during that time, and the Confederates basically evicted his wife and the rest of the family, so they had to make their way to Nashville to join Johnson as best they could.
Because this part of the state kind of went back and forth, didn't it?
It did. And
so
it was controlled by the Confederacy longer than Middle and West Tennessee, but this was an area that was very vital as far as the railroads were concerned.
I see. So a big chunk of Tennessee is taken by the Union in 1862. Johnson goes to Nashville, the state capital, to be the military governor. But his own family is left in this part of Tennessee, which even though it was more pro-Union to begin with, is actually more controlled by the Confederate
right.
We have to keep all this straight now.
Right.
And his wife and children are actually booted out of their house in Greenville.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
One of our rangers used to say it was safer to stay in the Army than it was to come home on leave during that time if you were from East Tennessee.
I believe it. I absolutely believe it. In fact, just to digress very slightly, one of the many skirmishes that occurred here in Greenville involved a famous Confederate general, didn't it?
It did. Jonathan Morgan, the Thunderbolt of the Confederacy.
The Thunderbolt of the Confederacy.
The house they were staying in was the Dixon Williams Mansion, and Mrs. Williams had son's fighting for both the Union and the Confederate armies, so anybody who came through town kind of considered that a safe house of where to go and stay.
And he was staying there, and apparently things caught up with him?
Things caught up with him.
Yeah, and I think some Union forces came over and sort of ambushed him, didn't
they
one
did.
Night?
In the garden the next morning after a dark and stormy night.
I see. That was General John Hunt Morgan, the Thunderbolt of the Confederacy, but that was a brief digression into local history.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and this week we're talking about the impeachment of President Andrew Johnson. Stay tuned.
But even the President of the United States sometimes must have to stand naked. The rules of the road have been lodged. It's only people's games that you got to dodge. And it's all right, Ma, I can make it.
I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm talking to Kendra Hinkle, Ranger Kendra Hinkle of the National Park Service, who's telling us all about President Andrew Johnson.
So it's the Civil War is still raging. East Tennessee is changing hands back and forth. Andrew Johnson's own family has to leave their home, and he is military governor. Now, what did he do as military governor? What sort of stuff did he have to do during that time?
He reestablished Union control, started setting up the state government, and interestingly, he freed all the slaves in Tennessee because...
He freed the slaves in Tennessee.
Tennessee was no longer considered a state in rebellion, so the Emancipation Proclamation did not extend here.
That's something most people don't appreciate. They think Emancipation Proclamation, you know, then you hear people say Lincoln freed the slaves.
Right.
It was a limited exercise of his Article II executive authority as commander-in-chief over areas... but we're still in rebellion.
Right.
And so the slaves, the freedom that was granted by the Emancipation Proclamation was relatively limited.
Right.
And it didn't cover Tennessee because Tennessee was no longer in rebellion. It had been pretty much completely Union controlled.
Right. So in October of 1864, I'm standing here upon the steps of the Capitol. I hereby proclaim freedom full, broad, and to every man in Tennessee.
Wow. Now, I'm sure he consulted with Lincoln before he did that, because he's still working for Lincoln as military governor. But, yeah, he actually had slaves himself.
And he freed, according to tradition, he freed his slaves on August 8th, 1863.
Right.
And to this day, that is referred to as Emancipation Day in Tennessee and surrounding areas.
In the state of Tennessee, and it's a very significant date.
It is.
Okay, so he frees his own slaves in August of 1863.
Mm-hmm. And the others in October of 1864.
But at any rate, he was the guy who did it here in Tennessee.
Right.
And rightly celebrated as the emancipator here in this state. So what else? I mean, was he a lenient governor, or was he a harsh governor? Did this endear him to his fellow Tennesseans or not?
It didn't. He pretty much meant business. Jailing pro-Confederate people. And so when he came up to Washington and Lincoln was assassinated and Johnson became president, the radical Republicans were initially hopeful that, you know, they finally had their man, to treason must be made odious and traitors put down.
Because he'd been pretty harsh as a military governor. Okay, well, before we get to that, I'm glad you mentioned that, let's talk about how he became vice president. So he's a military governor, and he's working. Now, who's Lincoln's first vice president?
Hannibal Hamlin.
Hamlin. Okay, that's a name everyone should remember.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently the Republicans in 1864 wanted a different vice presidential candidate. So why'd they pick Andrew Johnson?
I think one of the reasons Lincoln chose him, it was symbolically carrying out his malice toward none, charity toward all. It was bringing in a Southern Democrat. It was expanding his area of popularity, perhaps. It was bringing the North and South back together again. So it was just sort of, I think, a broad gesture to start the healing of the country.
Well, and it's kind of interesting because one can certainly see the importance of that during the Civil War. But really, in another sense, it's just the same reason why vice presidential candidates are always chosen, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. to help the president get
right.
elected.
Exactly.
And under the circumstances of that time.
It seemed the best choice.
Yeah, okay, and I could see why he would pick Johnson. Mm-hmm. If Johnson had been a loyal unionist and had been willing to go back to Tennessee and even be harsh when necessary.
Right, it was incorporating in the Democrats.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so now he's going to be, he's elected. Vice President, mm-hmm. takes his oath of office, I guess, in March, right? March
right.
of 1865. And so he settles down to the nice, cushy job of being Vice President, right?
Yes.
For about...
Well, he had been ill when he went to Washington. He had wanted to wait and see, you know, the Tennessee government come through and finish everything that he had started there. But Lincoln said, no, come on up to Washington for the inaugural. So he went. He'd been ill, and he had about 3 glasses of drink, I think, before he went and gave his vice presidential inaugural speech and mm-hmm. made a long, rambling, sort of embarrassing speech. Lincoln
was
said,
he a little bit lit?
Yes.
He shows up to be inaugurated as vice president, and he's had a few too many.
He has. And Lincoln stood up for him, saying, Andy's no drunk, but don't let him talk outside. So, really, the first few weeks of Johnson's vice presidency were just sort of being quiet and recuperating, not only from the illness that he'd had, but from the faux pas that he had made at his inaugural.
Well, you know, it's stressful being vice president or being inaugurated. I guess each of us handles it in his own way.
Right.
Okay. So
he had visited Hannibal Hamlin before he had gone in to make his speech, and there is some speculation that Hamlin may have said, here, this will make you feel better.
Are you serious? Hamlin resented, perhaps, being dropped from the ticket and may have hatched his own little plot to make his successor look bad. That sounds
Everything
plausible.
Just worked together for...
Well, you know, if you're already not feeling well, mm-hmm. and then you have alcohol,
head, right?
yeah, it might go to your head. Okay, so he's basically spending the first weeks of his vice presidency recovering from a hangover. And
the illness.
And the illness, and he's thinking, you know, no big deal. Vice president's kind of an easy job. And then, of course, the terrible tragedy happens, and Lincoln's assassinated. What can you tell us about that? What was his reaction upon becoming president?
It was sobering.
Uh-huh.
Johnson had been in his hotel room, or in his room, when someone came and told him what had happened, and Johnson went to see Lincoln, but he didn't stay long because Mary Todd wasn't happy with Johnson. Basically, so he left. The next morning, he was told of Lincoln's death and took the oath of office there in his room and took on the mantle of the presidency, gave Mary Todd several weeks to move out of the White House, during which time he had his office in the Treasury building.
So he was just staying in a hotel room in Washington, D.C., and that's where the oath of office took place.
Right.
I wonder, is that building still standing? I don't know where that is.
So.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. And he had someone who was supposed to assassinate him that night as well. But
that's right. Part of the conspiracy.
Working the other way for him, his supposed attacker got drunk at the bar and didn't fill out his task.
You know, I saw a slogan once that said, alcohol, the cause of and solution to all of life's problems.
There you go.
And I think in Johnson's case, that might have been mm-hmm. true. It mm-hmm. caused him embarrassment, but maybe it saved
his
life.
His life.
Okay, so he narrowly escapes the assassination plot. He takes the oath of office. So how did things go at first?
Well, at first, while Congress was out of session, Johnson started setting up his plan of restoration, and it was going quickly and well. And then when Congress came back into session...
Wait, before we do that, now let's clarify. Congress wasn't physically present
right.
for much of the year in Washington.
Right.
It was more like state legislatures are now. It was, you know, part of the year, and then they'd just be gone.
Right.
And travel, of course, was much slower and more difficult and all the rest of that. So he's by himself.
Right. Sort of Johnson's golden hour.
He was actually implementing the restoration plan, more or less, that Abraham Lincoln
right.
himself had written down, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yes. And then he and Congress began to butt heads because Congress wanted a harsher Reconstruction plan where they would break the South into military districts, have military commanders in charge of those districts, have to completely set up the new state and then reapply for admission to the Union. So between the two of them, neither side willing to compromise, that's when all the impeachment sort of started.
All the conflict started when Congress got back to town. I think, was that December of 65? Yeah, I think so, December. And this is interesting now, because most, you can never know what would have happened mm-hmm. if Lincoln had lived. But it's a reasonable speculation that he would have followed what he planned to follow. And, you know, as you say, with malice toward none, I think that was his second inaugural address, right? He was a conciliatory sort of fellow. Lincoln may have been able to carry that off, because Lincoln, of course, had just saved the Union. Lincoln had freed the slaves. Lincoln had won the Civil War. You know, Lincoln had lots of prestige and power, and he was the leader of the Republican Party. But Johnson, who faced an impossible situation, maybe even worse than John Adams after George Washington, maybe something akin to LBJ after John Kennedy, mm-hmm. comes on board. He wants to follow pretty much the same policy Lincoln might have followed, but he just doesn't have the power to pull it off. He's a Democrat. He's a Southerner. He was just somebody picked to elect Lincoln, and those Republicans in Congress are just not going to take that from him, are they?
And he, I don't think, had Lincoln's personality either. Mm-hmm. I think, Lincoln may have been more compromising or more willing to, meet them in the middle, maybe, but Johnson didn't have that in his personality.
Oh, he did? Was he somewhat combative?
Very stubborn,
mm-hmm.
very much adhered to what he believed was right, very much adhered to the principles of the Constitution, and every veto that he made, every decision that he made was based on what he felt was the constitutional interpretation.
Well, can we talk about that? Congress comes back in 1865, and so the conflicts begin. Mm-hmm. And I seem to recall from your visitor center that that Johnson vetoed, 29 or something different bills, a huge proportion of them that were passed. And what were some of the constitutional reasons that he vetoed some of those bills? I seem to recall that they had to do with his old states' rights theory,
Well, yes. He felt that many of the decisions that Congress was making were decisions that should be left to the individual states. He was very much for limited federal government.
Yeah. Even something that seems as uncontroversial as a Freedmen's Bureau. I was really sort of surprised to be reminded that he had vetoed that bill. I think maybe I'd known it some years ago and had forgotten it. Freedmen's Bureau was there to help and educate former slaves, even some white people in the South. You're thinking, okay, you can debate whether how much money you want to spend on this, but it's a pretty forward-looking program. It's fairly progressive. Who would be opposed to it? Well, Andrew Johnson was. Mm-hmm. Why? Because he felt that was something the states should do.
He felt it was unconstitutional because Congress had no right to legislate for unrepresented states.
Right, and that's very much a constitutional type argument as opposed to a policy type argument.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, didn't he oppose suffrage for black people, the black vote, at least being mandated on a federal level, because that was something?
Our film says he opposed black suffrage as it was being implemented. And one of my favorite quotes that Andrew Johnson says is, "If in the exercise of the constitutional guarantee that Congress shall secure to every state a republican form of government, universal suffrage for blacks as well as whites, the work of Reconstruction may as well begin in Ohio as in Virginia, in Pennsylvania as in North Carolina." So I think he was sort of calling them on the fact that it wasn't going to be universal suffrage throughout the country, and that many of the states, even in the North, were against it as much as people in the South.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It was something definitely to work toward, but it wasn't going to be easy.
Right. The North did not have clean hands when it came to suffrage for black people. and wouldn't for a number of years. But this is what really strikes me about Andrew Johnson. He sounds like a constitutional law professor. Mm-hmm. I mean, you read his speeches or excerpts from his speeches when he talks about why he vetoed this bill or vetoed that bill. It was like this guy's really been studying this stuff. And so that's extremely impressive. I mean, this is a guy who was a tailor in a little tiny wood building in a little town in East Tennessee, and he's up there making decisions on the great issues of the day because, well, you know, the Constitution says this, and it says that, and we've got to follow the Constitution. He really was a defender of the Constitution.
Very much. And one of the things that I think is very interesting about Johnson's presidency is that not only was the fabric of the nation completely different after the Civil War, this was the first time that you had a president who had never been either a military hero nor who had studied law.
See, another thing that was against him, I mean, the circumstances were conspiring.
Right.
He's from humble beginnings. He's following Lincoln. There's been an assassination.
Right.
He's not a war hero. He's not even a lawyer. It's like the guy has no credibility.
Right.
He could be as right as rain, and they're still going to fight against him.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to implement Lincoln's policies, at least as best he could discern it, and still everybody's against
right.
him. He just didn't get any respect, did he?
Right.
Okay. So he starts vetoing these bills. Mm-hmm. And Congress gets angry with him. What happened?
Overriding the bills that he vetoes. And really, he lived under the shadow of impeachment for nearly his entire term. In 1866, Congress made the first attempt an inquiry to see if Johnson was in on the Lincoln assassination. Of course, that was
Whoa! Wait a minute. Wait. They thought Johnson might have been one
the conspirator, right?
No way.
So they investigated that in the spring and summer of 1867. The second investigation into impeachment, 5-4 against. In the fall of 1867, they began talks again, especially when Johnson suspended his Secretary of War, Stanton.
Right.
And it was in the winter of February 1868, when Johnson fired Stanton, his Secretary of War, that they felt he had violated the Tenure of Office Act.
Now, let's back up on that. Now, Johnson did something that ultimately may have been his near undoing, and that is that he kept pretty much intact Lincoln's cabinet, right?
Yes.
And maybe out of respect for Lincoln, or maybe because he liked the guys, whatever his reasons, he kept the cabinet, and that seemed to work pretty well. But when Congress came back and had all these different ideas about Reconstruction, Congress saw keeping Lincoln's cabinet as a way to keep some sort of control of Johnson.
Well, especially through Secretary of War Edwin Stanton.
Why was he so important?
He sort of allied himself with the radical Republicans.
Oh, okay.
Was a thorn in Johnson's side. Perhaps, you know, keeping some documentation from him in regard to pivotal events during the time. So Johnson fired him after suspending him. Some people have speculated that it was a way for Johnson to test the constitutionality of the Tenure of Office Act.
And let's talk about that specifically. Normally speaking, at least prior to the passage of this so-called Tenure in Office Act, the president chooses his cabinet, and then they have to all be confirmed by the Senate. Mm-hmm. But that's fine. That's right in the Constitution. But there's nothing in the Constitution about firing people. And up to that time, if a president didn't like his Secretary of War or his Secretary of the Treasury, he just fired him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, thank you for your service, and now you're being
replaced.
Goodbye. Exactly right. And the Constitution's still silent on that point. So by passing a statute, the Tenure in Office Act, which said you can't fire someone who's been confirmed by the Senate, at least during the term of the president who appointed him.
And that was the catch
there. Right. But just by saying that, just by trying to put some limit, and especially when you think about the Secretary of War as being someone who is in the chain of command, you know, the president's commander-in-chief, that creates the constitutional issue. You know, I should be able to fire anybody that I want to fire who works for me. Every other president has. And I especially should be able to fire somebody who's in the military chain of command. So that's what Congress did by passing that act over his veto, and that's why he thought it was unconstitutional. And so old obstinate Andrew What does he do as soon as the Tenure in Office Act is passed over his veto?
Fires his Secretary of War.
Just fires him out the door.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was...
I think one quote said, let them impeach and be damned.
Let them... let them impeach and be damned. And that's what they did.
That's what they did.
Now, let's clarify. Impeachment doesn't mean you're removed, right?
Right. And that's one of our biggest challenges, to clarify that impeachment does not mean removal from office. It is an indictment. The House of Representatives has the sole power to impeach, and then the Senate has the sole power to try the case, and in the case of a presidential impeachment, with the Chief Justice presiding. And it's only if two-thirds of the majority vote conviction that the president is removed from office.
Okay, so impeachment means essentially accusation.
Exactly.
And I believe the relevant language says that the president has to have committed a high crime or misdemeanor.
Right, which is nefarious at best.
Right. I mean, who knows exactly what those things mean. In fact, 100 years later, under very different circumstances, I think it was, wasn't it Gerald Ford, who said a high crime and misdemeanors, whatever the House of Representatives says it. Yeah, wants it to be, right.
Exactly.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and we've been talking to Ranger Kendra Hinkle of the Andrew Johnson National Historic Site. After the break, we'll talk some more with Kendra, and then maybe a little other stuff as well. Stay tuned.
Meet the new boss. Same as the old boss.
I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm talking to Ranger Kendra Hinkle of the Andrew Johnson National Historic Site.
So all they have to do basically is draw up articles of impeachment, and what did those articles basically complain of?
Well, there were 11 articles of impeachment, and the violation of the Tenure of Office Act made up 8 out of those 11 articles. So we have removal of Stanton, conspiracy by appointing Lorenzo Thomas as Secretary of War at interim, appointment of Thomas without congressional approval, conspiring to prevent Stanton from holding office, conspiring to prevent and hinder the Tenure of Office Act, conspired to seize, take, and possess the War Department. So a lot of them either dealt with him breaking the Tenure of Office Act or conspiring to break the Tenure of Office Act.
Go ahead. The spaghetti theory. You throw all the spaghetti up against the wall and you see which of them might stick.
So
they're charging him with every possible permutation of having fired Edwin Stanton.
And number 10, basically the intent to disgrace, ridicule, show hatred for, and contempt and reproach of the United States Congress.
In fact, that was my favorite one. I was reading the articles of impeachment before we spoke, and they actually quote from a speech or two he gave where he used some fairly strong language about Congress. And so that was a high crime or misdemeanor, was just insulting Congress.
Right, exactly.
Okay. Anything else in the articles of impeachment, or is that pretty much it?
That pretty much sums them up. The 11th article said that Johnson declared and affirmed that the 39th Congress wasn't authorized by the Constitution to exercise legislative power and attempted to prevent the Tenure Act. And, you know, I think Johnson saw what he was doing as also defending the presidency and the system of balance of powers within the government.
Yeah, he certainly did. In fact, in one sense, you could see Congress almost laying a trap for him, daring him to fire Stanton, because Stanton's already been suspended prior to this.
Right.
And so they're daring him to fire it, and in a sense, he took the bait.
Right.
But on the other hand, from his perspective, he did it because he wanted to force the issue, and he was standing up for the powers of the presidency as opposed to the Congress.
Exactly.
So now we've got an impeachment, we've got an accusation. What happened then?
Well, Johnson got a very good defense team.
Oh, who were the lawyers he hired?
All right. Henry Stanberry, who resigned as Attorney General, so there was no conflict of interest. Benjamin Curtis, William Grosbeck, William Everts, and Thomas A. R. Nelson of Tennessee. So he balanced his defense team. He had two moderate Republicans, two war Democrats, and one conservative Democrat. So it was sort of a brilliant strategy on his part.
Right.
And this was a very good team that defended him, told Johnson not to show up at the trial, not to make any speeches, and that they would take care of it all. And Curtis's opening speech is considered one of the brilliant speeches in
Really? Well, I'm going to have to look at that, because I have to admit I'm ignorant of that. Now, the actual order of proceedings was that, first of all, everybody gets together in the House chamber, right? Because that's the bigger one, and the Senate is brought there. Or was it in the Senate chamber?
I think it was in the Senate
chamber. In the Senate chamber, because, okay, it's the Senate that's actually is going to be the jury,
right? Exactly.
That's how an impeachment works. The Senate's going to vote, and two-thirds of those senators, and I think at that time, how many?
Two-thirds present.
The judge in the impeachment is the Supreme Court's Chief Justice,
right.
The Chief Justice of the United States, who at that time was...
Salmon P. Chase,
who had been one of Lincoln's rivals in the 1860 election and whom Lincoln had subsequently appointed.
And it's sort of ironic that, you know, Chase had been the one who gave Andrew Johnson the oath of office. And the Bible that we have in our museum is signed Salmon P. Chase because he presented the Bible to Andrew Johnson. So it's just a little ironic story there.
Okay, so Salmon P. Chase sitting up there, he's the judge. The senators are arrayed in their chamber. They're going to be the jury. Johnson actually shows up, right? Oh, he doesn't show up. Okay, good. So at the beginning of the trial, the House members read the indictment. They present their case, their indictment, and that takes some time, doesn't it? In fact, they start on March 30th, I think, of 1868. And then after they've presented their case at length, then Andrew Johnson's lawyers come. And you were just telling me Andrew Johnson's lawyer said, don't show up.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't show up.
Right.
Okay, well, I'm learning something here. I thought he was actually present. So the first guy is Curtis, and he makes this opening speech. And you say that that's a particularly notable speech.
Right. I think he covered things so brilliantly that Benjamin Butler said that he didn't leave anything else for any of the defense lawyers to talk about.
That's a pretty effective speech.
It is, especially coming from Butler.
Okay, so then they continue their defense,
mm-hmm.
and the trial lasts several
weeks. The first
weeks.
Vote was on May 16th.
Wow. So basically all through April and the first part of May.
Right. And they voted on Article 11 first, believing that one had the most support. And it came out 35 guilty, 19 not guilty, which was one vote short of the needed two-thirds to convict.
One vote short. So if one more senator had voted to convict Andrew Johnson, he would have been removed from office.
Right.
Now, who were the holdouts, and did it come down to a dramatic conclusion?
There were seven undecided Republicans, and the one that made the pivotal decision was Edmund Ross of Kansas. Mm-hmm. And realizing, you know, that it would be his political downfall to do so, but he felt that that was in the right.
So he cast a vote for acquittal,
mm-hmm.
knowing that it would lead to his own loss at the next election,
yes.
in Kansas. Did that in fact happen?
Absolutely.
He sacrificed his own political career.
He did. And the Senate took another vote on May 26th, and the vote was exactly the same, 35 to 19. So those seven moderate Republicans held out.
And they only voted on two of the 11 articles?
They took up Article 3.
Mm-hmm.
It was, again, 35 to 19. And it says, because all of the other articles charged Johnson with conspiring to violate the Tenure of Office Act, and they had already proved that he did not violate the law, there was no point in going on. So it looks like they voted on three of them.
Okay.
Article 11, 2, and 6.
And when they got to that point, they realized that they were beaten,
right.
and they dropped it. Wow. So talk about bringing it down to a razor's edge conclusion.
Absolutely.
And a remarkable one. Who's that fellow from Kansas again? Edmund Ross?
Edmund Ross. Well, and he ended up being one of the people Kennedy profiled in his Profiles in Courage series.
That's where I remember the name from. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, the theme of that book by John F. Kennedy was people sacrificing their own interests for the greater good. And that is a classic case. Well, we should remember Edmund Ross's name and salute him for voting his conscience.
Absolutely.
Very interesting. Well, what else can you tell us about Andrew Johnson's career after he survived impeachment?
Well, he holds the distinction of being the only U.S. president ever to return to the Senate. So that was a very good vindication for Andrew Johnson to return to the Senate that had presided over his impeachment trial.
It is remarkable, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I had not thought of it that way. Mm-hmm. So he came back to Tennessee after, I guess, 1869, when U.S. Grant became...
He began running for office almost immediately, and he had two failed attempts, and then on this third one, he was voted back into the Senate.
You know, you'd think the guy would be tired of politics, and I wonder why he decided he was going to start running for U.S. Senator or U.S. Congress as soon as he left office as president.
I think he honestly thrived on it, and I think he wanted the Democratic... the nomination at the Democratic Convention, but it went to Horatio Seymour instead. So I think
the famous Horatio Seymour,
exactly,
whom we all remember.
We all know his name.
Exactly.
But against Grant, you know, it would have been hard for anybody to win, because there again, you had your military hero.
Right. Yeah, so he wanted another term in office, mm-hmm, and didn't even get his own party's nomination.
Right.
So he leaves D.C., comes back to Tennessee, and immediately starts running for federal office from Tennessee. Mm-hmm. Takes him 3 attempts, but he finally gets sent back to the Senate.
Right.
So did he serve a long and illustrious second Senate career?
He did not. Grant had called a special session, and Johnson got to attend that. But that same summer, while visiting his daughter's home in Carter County, Tennessee, near present-day Elizabethton, he had a massive stroke and died at her house.
Well, that's a pity he didn't get a chance to hang out with his fellow senators any longer than that, but he got to attend at least that one session.
He did. He got his vindication.
Well, good for him. Anything else you'd care to add about Andrew Johnson?
That there were lots of successes during his presidency as well. The United States bought Alaska during Andrew Johnson's administration. There was the annexation.
You know, wait a second. That is really overlooked. People mm-hmm. will remember, if they remember anything about buying Alaska from Russia, they remember Seward's folly.
Right.
But Seward was Secretary of State who had been appointed by Lincoln.
Right.
And then Lincoln, Johnson kept him afterward. So Johnson was the president who actually pushed that through, okay? And that is quite significant.
It is. There was the annexation of Midway Island. There was the completion of a transatlantic cable, and he was the first president to communicate with Queen Victoria.
Very interesting.
And during his administration, Charles Dickens visited the White House. And Queen Emma of the Sandwich Islands visited the White House. It was the first time a queen had ever visited the White House.
Isn't that interesting? I think it might have been Barack Obama, or it might have been an earlier president, who said one of the coolest things about being president is that you invite anybody you want to your house and they always come.
They will come. That's
right. So you got Charles Dickens.
Well, wasn't that a great conversation with Ranger Kendra Hinkle? But, you know, she wasn't the only ranger there at the Andrew Johnson Historical Site. I also spoke at length with another ranger by the name of Daniel Luther, who was the fellow who gave the tour of Andrew Johnson's homestead in Greenville, Tennessee. And he had some very interesting insights into Andrew Johnson's legacy.
And, of course, Johnson is the first to take office on the assassination of his predecessor. That's just one element in an impossible, I would say, situation that he stepped into. Very unlikely, in my mind, that Lincoln would have the godlike status that he does today had he had to remain in office and deal with Reconstruction. It's a very, very difficult one, and of course that will lead to the impeachment.
Didn't Johnson take a lot of Lincoln's ideas into Reconstruction?
He did. And of course, we're dealing with a time here where only did Andrew Johnson have Lincoln's framework for Reconstruction, the 10% plan, providing enough of a voting bloc in the former Confederate states to begin the process of reentering the Union, Lincoln's strong desire that there not be military Reconstruction, that the casual comment made to by Lincoln to Grant that he wanted to let the South up easy, Lincoln's views that the primary goals would be making sure that slavery ended, and that even a comment Lincoln made at his last cabinet meeting, which is that something to the effect that it is just as well that the rebellion has collapsed just as Congress has gone out of session, because in Lincoln's view they would do better with Reconstruction without Congress than they would with. And Johnson did that and was criticized for not calling a special session of it. Johnson essentially put in place the framework that Lincoln had sketched out, and we do know that the two men discussed the progress of the war as well as probably looking forward to what would happen after. But you would have to say, though, in fairness, that Lincoln is not considered our greatest president for no reason, and Johnson lacked personal qualities that Lincoln had in abundance that would have helped. Johnson simply felt, I believe, that in the state of turmoil that existed at the end of the Civil War, that we needed stability, and we needed it quickly. And in Johnson's view, the best place to find it was the Constitution. That had always been his view, that the Constitution was the pattern, if you will. I mean, he was a tailor. I think he saw the world this way. The Constitution was the pattern that makes it possible for a nation of differing opinions and social classes and so forth to be able to self-govern. And I think Johnson looked at his own life as the example of how successful that could be. And so when we needed to return to something that was not the turmoil that we've gone through the previous 4 years, that's where he looked. And that is where he found his primary objections to the way the Congress was proceeding.
Well, once again, the tyranny of the clock intrudes, and we've only got a minute or so left, but I'm going to go back to my student, Eric von Kleist. Any last thoughts about impeachment after our discussion about Andrew Johnson?
Well, it's interesting, Professor Harris, that the founders during the Constitutional Convention weren't decided upon having impeachment at all. At first, they thought that there might not be a reason to have impeachment, but then Ben Franklin pointed out to them that without an impeachment process, the only way to remove a president from office was to assassinate him.
Ouch.
And that took away his not only his life, but his chance to vindicate himself in a court of law. So the founders gave the process to a detail committee, and the detail committee gave us the process that we have today.
I see. Well, a necessary provision, but always inevitably a troublesome provision of our Constitution. So thank you very much for those closing thoughts. And thank you very much to the Andrew Johnson National Historic Site. Thank you to the Rangers I spoke to, Kendra Hinkle and Daniel Luther. Thanks also to their supervisor, Anita Clark, who was very helpful in setting up those interviews. Thank you to my engineer, Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, oh, it's your Constitution. That's right. So you need to learn about it.